we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, March the 23rd, 2008. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Sinead Sanders. Before we start, I wanted to acknowledge two special birthdays that are happening this week. Today is our former co-host Caroline Carnery's birthday. So happy birthday to you, Caroline, and thank you for being a voice for the animals. Also, tomorrow, March the 24th, marks the birthday of our local super animal activist, Jeff Regier. Thank you for working tirelessly to open people's hearts and minds with regards to how we treat animals. And I know he will be spending his birthday weekend with his TV outreach for animals at the Juno Awards. Best wishes to both Caroline and Jeff. We appreciate you so much. Here in North America, we often ask people why they love dogs but eat pigs and cows. But in countries such as China, India, and South Korea, people eat the animals who we call our canine companions. Although most people in South Korea don't regularly eat dogs, an estimated 2.5 million dogs of all types are still bred and killed each year for human consumption in over 17,000 facilities. The Humane Society International has helped shut down 11 dog meat farms so far and has rescued about 1,300 dogs in South Korea. In our first interview, Rebecca Aldworth from HSI will be here to tell us about the campaign and the recent rescue of over 180 dogs who have been brought to Canada to be adopted out into forever homes. Then for our feature interview, we have a world champion figure skater on the show, recently back from Pyeongchang, South Korea, where she and her partner won both a gold and bronze medal in the pair skating events. Megan Duhamel is powered by plants and has been vegan since 2008. In our profile interview with her, she will tell us about how she has come to succeed as a world-class athlete on a vegan diet and how veganism has opened her awareness and compassion for all those in the world, including her mini Dachshund Mute, who has been rescued from a dog meat farm in South Korea last year. So that interview is coming out in about 27 minutes. Please do stay tuned. And now, Sinead, we're going to do something that we haven't done before. Can you guess what that might be?
Well, I hear we're making a mystery phone call.
Okay. Here's the mystery phone call. I've never done this before, but let's see if it works. Okay, so I think it's ringing. Let's see here. Hey, Jillian.
Hi.
Hello, Jillian.
How are you doing?
It's good to hear you. We don't have you in the studio, but we
this
have
is Jillian, our co-host. She's on the island this week.
So, Jillian, you were at the Joanne MacArthur event last Saturday, I understand, yeah?
Yeah, and I was just kind of thinking about it. And, you know, I was sitting in my car waiting to go, and I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to see those images today?
Well,
and I think a lot of people might think that, right? Because it's not easy, and she mentions that in her lecture, that it's not easy to see the images. But you know what? I was so glad that I went. It was sad. I wish they gave up Kleenexes, because more than the photos were sad, it was the stories behind the photos.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to give listeners who aren't familiar, we've talked about Joanne MacArthur on the show. We've had her on the show before. She photographs animals who are exploited all over the world in all sorts of circumstances, slaughterhouses, zoos and aquariums, and all sorts of things. So you were familiar with her work, and I'm sure it was hard for you to see. What do you think the audience response was?
I would think it was, I found it really motivating, actually. Like, I didn't leave feeling sad. I felt energetic and excited to, and motivated to work harder for the animals.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, I hear you there.
I want to say that Joanne MacArthur is such a brilliant photojournalist, and we were lucky to actually host her last year when she came into Vancouver, and she was here this past week as well. And if you're not familiar with her photography, go to her website, We Animals, and she also has a project called the Unbound Project that we've featured on the show before with her partner, Dr. Carrie Cronin. Can you speak a little bit about what that is, Jillian?
Yeah, I found this actually super exciting, and they actually have an awesome website, unboundproject.org, and it features women on the front lines of animal advocacy worldwide, so people like Jane Goodall, and also young women that are just starting out and breaking ground in the animal rights movement. And it's a wonderful website. I could spend hours on there reading all the stories.
Yeah, so speaking of using your creativity for animals, you've been doing that lately, and I'm so proud of you, Jillian. You have this wonderful Kickstarter campaign that you have launched this week, and actually, Sinead and I saw you at the Happy Herd Sanctuary a couple weekends ago when you were filming a video for it. And can you tell us just, we only have like a minute left, can you tell us a little bit about that? But for sure we'll talk about it more on the show next week.
Yeah, so the Kickstarter started, I launched it on Wednesday night. So I'm raising money for the printing and distributing of the book. So it's the first in a series. It's volume one, and it's Animals Used for Food. And so each volume is explores an area of animal exploitation. And so it follows Kingston's real-life experiences in activism, and it's the only, there's no other books out there that I know of that focus on veganism and activism as the same.
Right.
So it's a great way to teach kids how they can use their voice and follow their passion and decide which form of activism works best for them, because I know Kingston's tried everything, and there's certain things he loves and certain things he doesn't like.
Well, for sure, people should check out our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and our website, animalvoices.org. There's a link to your Kickstarter on there, and we'll talk to you more about it next week. Thanks,
sure.
Jillian.
Okay.
Yeah, see you next week. Enjoy.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
And now for some events. We've got a few things coming up in the next week, starting tomorrow morning. excuse me. So tomorrow morning, Saturday, March 24th, Vancouver Chicken Save will be at the Hallmark Slaughterhouse at Hastings and Commercial Drive, as they are every Saturday morning. But this time, they're holding a vigil for someone else in addition to the birds. This week marked 5 years since the death of Hallmark Slaughterhouse worker Bao Min Cheng. He died at the age of 42 from heart failure after working a 13-hour shift at Hallmark. After his death, his wife and their four young children were forced to live off welfare, and his family sued Hallmark for negligence in 2015. So Vancouver Chicken Save will be bearing witness to the chickens and encouraging compassion as usual, but will also be raising awareness of what goes on behind slaughterhouse walls for the human victims of the industry. So instead of the usual 2 hours, this vigil will run for 13 hours, the length of the shift that Bao Min Cheng worked before he died. So they're starting at 5 a.m. and going until 6 p.m. And there's no problem if you can't stay the whole 13 hours. Just show up for however long you can. And again, that's 5 a.m. to 6 p.m. in front of the Hallmark Slaughterhouse on the corner of East Hastings and Commercial Drive. There's more info on their social media, Vancouver Chicken Save. Also this weekend, we have TV Outreach for Animals TV outreach for animals will be at the Junos. So as I'm sure many of you have heard, the Junos are coming to Vancouver this weekend. TV Outreach for Animals is taking this opportunity to reach out to the thousands of Juno attendees as they leave the event. From 10:30 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. on Sunday night, they'll be set up at Stadium Chinatown Station, screening modern farm and slaughterhouse footage to the public. You can join to hold signs, hand out leaflets, and chat with people who are interested in learning more. And yeah, you know, you may have seen TV Outreach for Animals, Jeff Regeer, whose birthday it is. Hello, Jeff. they set up at the train stations around town and screen this stuff. And the nasty stuff you see on the screen, it only happens because people keep paying for it. So good on Jeff and everybody there for keeping that going. And one more event, Tuesday, March 27th at the Vancouver Public Library, the Vancouver Humane Society is hosting a talk called Nature in a Box, the Paradoxical and Dangerous World of Zoos and Aquariums. And that's featuring Rob Laidlaw, who is an author and biologist and a great speaker. So do check that out. That's 7 p.m. at the downtown library this Tuesday, March 27th. Tickets are $10 and can be purchased online in advance. To learn more and reserve your tickets, just go to vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. If you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Thanks so much for the events, Sinead. Our first interview today is with Rebecca Aldworth, the Executive Director of the Humane Society International. As part of a broader campaign to end the dog meat industry in Asia, HSI has recently shut down a dog meat farm in South Korea from which 80 dogs have been brought last week to the organization's emergency shelter in Montreal. Although most people in South Korea don't regularly eat dogs, an estimated 2.5 million dogs of all types are still bred and killed each year for human consumption. HSI has helped shut down 11 dog meat farms so far and has rescued about 1,300 dogs in South Korea. And Rebecca is here today to tell us more about this campaign. Hello, Rebecca. Welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, the Humane Society International is actively working to end the dog meat trade across Asia as it affects other countries such as China, Indonesia, and India as well. But let's talk about your work in South Korea today. Can you start by telling us about the history of the dog meat industry in South Korea? I understand that there are about 17,000 facilities in South Korea that are killing an estimated 2.5 million dogs per year.
That's right. People in South Korea have eaten dogs for hundreds of years, but it was really during the Civil War that it grew into a much larger industry. And today it's a large commercial operation that occurs in South Korea. As you mentioned, there are an estimated 17,000 farms there, which produce approximately 2.5 million dogs for slaughter every single year. Of course, no one really knows how many dog meat farms are out there because they're not registered. There's very little information on them. So these are just estimates that we're working with.
I'm wondering, too, where do the dogs come from? Because there are, from the photos I've seen, there's all different breeds of dogs. And also I've heard that some dogs have actually been companion animals of people in South Korea. Is that true?
Well, South Korea is the only country in Asia that intensively farms dogs on such a big level to produce dogs for the dog meat trade. But many people in South Korea who no longer want their companion animals will dump them at dog meat farms. So we do see lots of companion animals there. Just as bad, at one point, South Korea, the government was really actively pursuing dog breeding as an economic activity for citizens and invested very heavily in it. And a lot of people set up puppy mills across South Korea. When the industry started to take a downward turn, a lot of those facilities turned into dog meat farms. And so we see all kinds of breeds that you would expect in a puppy mill also existing in dog meat farms in South Korea.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask you, can you paint us a picture of the conditions of the dog meat farms in South Korea and how the dogs are killed?
So I went over to visit the dog meat farm that we've just closed a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I've been in factory farms across Canada. I've been in puppy mills. And I have to say, this place hit me very hard. We see multiple dogs crammed into wire cages, completely exposed to the element. They have no protection whatsoever. They are shivering from the cold. They have no food, no water. We see dogs that are chained to stakes in the ground, lying on, you know, frozen mud with nothing, no shelter, no way to get themselves warm. These dogs have many injuries from the wire that they're forced to live on. They've got open sores on their bodies. Their feet are sometimes deformed because of that. It's really horrific. And I think one of the biggest things that you see there is just the impact of the lack of care, the lack of socialization on these dogs. They're often very afraid. They cower when people come near. And it's truly, truly heartbreaking to witness what they live through. For many of these dogs, they've not just been on those farms for a few days or a few weeks. Some of them have been there for many years in those conditions.
Well, I know the Humane Society International has been instrumental in shutting down 11 dog meat farms so far in South Korea. Can you tell us about the goal of this campaign and how you are working with the dog farmers to transition to another means of income so that they can stop killing dogs for their livelihoods?
We're working in South Korea to end the dog meat trade forever, and we're working with local animal protection groups and local animal advocates, but also with dog meat farmers who are eager to transition out of the industry. We're seeing a rapidly growing pet culture in South Korea, and along with that, opposition to the dog meat trade is growing. So we work with farmers who want to get out of this industry. We sign a contract with them that they will never return to dog meat farming. And we help them to get set up in a new humane business. And those businesses vary enormously depending on the skill set that the dog farmer brings to the table. But, for example, this latest farmer is transitioning into mushroom farming. And we help them, of course, in dealing with the dogs that they have in their facility. And unfortunately, the shelters in South Korea are completely overwhelmed. If we put these dogs into shelters in South Korea, they would spend literally years before they would be adopted, if ever, in those shelters. And so we bring them overseas where we know forever homes are waiting.
Rebecca, the dog meat industry is in legal limbo, it's been called, in South Korea. Can you explain what this means?
So right now in South Korea, there are some fairly ambiguous animal protection laws that in theory could make parts of the trade illegal. There's also increasing political will to shut down the dog meat trade. So there's now a bill to end the dog meat trade that's being put forward. Right now, what we're trying to do through our dog meat transition program is to create an economic model that the government of South Korea can follow on a mass scale when they decide to end the trade. So it's a proof of concept model. We need to show that there is a solution that can be applied to ending the dog meat trade that will benefit both the dogs and the farmers.
And would you say that this could definitely set an example and a model to shut down the dog meat trade in countries such as China?
It's a different model that will be needed in China, because what we see in China are animals stolen off the streets, stolen from homes, rounded up, transported long distances, and then slaughtered. So it's a very different approach that we have in China. There, we need to enforce existing animal protection laws and existing transport laws. And the question is getting government will to enforce those laws, which would severely curtail the industry. And then ultimately, we need a ban in China as well.
Sinead has another question for you here.
Yeah, I understand that HSI has now rescued about 1,300 dogs in South Korea. Can you tell us about the 80 dogs who were brought to your emergency shelter in Montreal last week and why they were brought to Canada?
So there's 88 dogs now in total, and the number increased as we had puppies born on the farm. They're just incredible dogs. The capacity of dogs to learn to trust again, to forgive us, is something that I just see again and again. When we shut down these facilities where they've been subjected to so much cruelty, it never ceases to amaze me. But these dogs, in the few days that they've been in Canada, are already starting to come out of their shells. We have volunteers and staff people working with them around the clock. Really just getting them used to things as simple as walking on solid ground, eating dog food, having a dog treat, lying on a blanket, really basic things that we all take for granted. These dogs have to learn from scratch. They obviously have lived a life of severe deprivation, and many of them bear the physical scars of that. But they're coming back one day at a time. You know, again, these dogs in South Korea would not have a hope of being put into a home. There is a tragic perception in South Korea that there's two kinds of dogs, that there's dog meat farm dogs and then there's pet dogs. And it's something we're actively working there to dispel. But while that myth persists, it's very difficult to place these dogs there. But here, we will have them in forever homes within weeks.
I understand, too, that the dog meat trade in South Korea is really dwindling. It's more of the older generation that are into eating dogs. I also understand that. So maybe you can sort of dispel these myths, because I'm hearing different things. Yeah. Also, during the Olympics, restaurants were encouraged to stop selling dog meat, but not all of them did, or they didn't want to because they were afraid that their customers wouldn't come back. So I'm hearing kind of different things here. It's dying, but restaurants didn't want to take it off their menu. So what do you see as the culture of eating dogs in South Korea these days?
So we've surveyed people in South Korea, and we know the majority of people there don't eat dog meat on a regular basis and certainly haven't recently. We do know that dog meat eating is much more prevalent with older people, particularly older men, that the younger generation really doesn't have any interest in eating dog meat. Our South Korea policy specialist came over here with the dogs, and I was talking to her about perceptions in Korea. And she was just saying, you know, I don't eat dog meat, obviously. Nobody I know eats dog meat. The younger generation just want nothing to do with this. And I think it's also very important to know that this is a campaign that is led by advocates from South Korea, who've been working for many, many years to combat the cruelty of the dog meat trade. And they are fantastic people, very hard workers, and our role is to support them in that. We also hear from the dog meat traders, and they're pretty frank with us that this is an industry in decline. They're seeing prices for dog meat declining. Their farms are doing less business, and there's less money in this industry for them. And that's why, you know, as word has been spreading about our program, so many of them are approaching us now and asking for our help to transition out.
So I can understand that HSI, I mean, there's so many problems and issues of exploitation with animals in the world. Some people are asking, or some people say this is a speciesist campaign, but I can see, because, you know, we kill other animals and there's, I mean, there's no like specific campaigns to shut down cow farms, for example, or chicken farms with around the world. But I see this sort of as being, you're saying that people in South Korea are asking for help, so therefore you're giving it to them. Is that sort of the approach that you're taking into how HSI can be effective with the broader spectrum of animal exploitation? I mean, we can't do it all at once. So it's sort of like,
well,
taking
actually,
one thing at a time.
I would argue that we do it all at once.
Okay.
If you look at our organization, you'll see Stopping Cruelty on Factory Farms is one of our largest campaigns internationally, and it is because of the sheer scale of suffering involved in factory farms. But at the same time, this is an industry that kills 30 million dogs every year, and it's an industry that is entirely unregulated, where in transport we routinely see mortality rates of up to 70% of the dogs in transport. Mortality from suffocation because they're crammed into wire cages together and literally die of heat exhaustion and a lack of oxygen during transport. It's an operation where we see dogs abused and sometimes even tortured before they're slaughtered, where the slaughtering processes are completely inhumane. In South Korea, it's death by electrocution, which can take many minutes to kill a dog. So I'm not trying to compare the one to the other. I'm saying that the dog meat trade is in urgent need of our attention. And as an organization that works to protect the welfare of animals, we bring our resources to the table to support the very brave and outspoken local activists who are working to shut this industry down.
Well, thank you for that. How can our listeners help with this campaign, Rebecca, and specifically if they want to adopt one of these dogs?
So I would urge everybody to visit hsicanada.ca/savedogs, and they can find out more about volunteering, about adopting a dog, about donating to this campaign. They can also visit hsi.org, where there's more information on the larger Global Dog Meat campaign. We welcome support from anyone out there in the public. We all do what we can to save these dogs, and we need the community to stand behind us in making this rescue a success.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, for coming on the show today to tell us about your work in shutting down dog meat farms in South Korea and the current rescue of these 88 dogs from a recently shut down dog farm. To find out more about HSI's work, you can visit their website, as you said, at hsi.org. Thank you, Rebecca. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
All right, and now for some news. There was some really cool news this week out of San Francisco. San Francisco became the largest city in the U.S. to ban fur sales.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And one of the first city, I think the third city, right?
Yeah.
After West Hollywood and can't remember.
Berkeley.
What else. Berkeley. There mm-hmm. we go. So they're all in California.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Good movement going on there. And all these fashion designers we're hearing, it seems like every week there's a new big fashion designer.
Versace was last week.
Yeah. Versace. There's a whole list. You can go online and see all these major fashion designers are dropping fur because people are finally recognizing it doesn't make any sense to be killing these animals and torturing them in these fur farms for fur trim and things, you know, fashion related things that are just so far from necessary. It's outrageous. But so over the past few months, In Defense of Animals, a group in San Francisco, along with Compassion Over Killing, has been
Direct Action Everywhere.
Yeah. A few groups have been involved working with the city government, and yeah, it was a unanimous vote. They voted to ban fur sales. This doesn't apply to thrift stores and things. This is just new sales of fur. They're saying the industry should not exist, really. So retailers have until December 31st, 2019 to clear out their old stock.
And do you realize that this means that Canada Goose will not be able to sell fur in such a major city?
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I hope Vancouver follows suit soon, because we have too many of those sales here, and I see them around way too much. Even though the weather has brightened up a bit this week, I'm still seeing students on campus wearing mm-hmm. these jackets.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. So this fur ban isn't actually quite a done deal just yet. There's a slim chance that the ordinance could be amended or some such thing. So keeping the pressure on is important, and just recognizing, yeah, needless suffering, let's not do it. Speaking of which, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a lot of people have heard about that, and there have been a lot of campaigns to reduce single-use plastic because of it, which is awesome and important, but a study came out this week. They said that nearly 50%, 46% of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is actually made up of fishing gear. So in this whole conversation to reduce single-use plastic and the responsibility of consumers to reduce their plastic consumption, there, you know, half of this mess in the ocean is coming from the fishing industry. So on that note, it's actually the World Day to End Fishing this Saturday, March 24th. This is a global campaign, and there is something happening here in Vancouver. We have it posted on our Facebook page. It's taking place downtown at 12:30. I'm sorry, I just learned about this before this thing here, but World Day to End Fishing. It's really, the commercial fishing industry is destroying the oceans, and as a result, the like life on this planet. So reducing our plastic consumption is important, but reducing eliminating our consumption of sea life is equally important, because it's having devastating effects. You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories.
Our feature interview today is with Canadian figure skating champion Megan Duhamel. Megan is a two-time world champion figure skater, an Olympic gold, silver, and bronze medalist, and a seven-time Canadian national champion in pair skating. Just recently, she came back from the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, having taken both a gold and bronze medal there in the team event in pair skating. Megan is also a vegan and an avid animal advocate and has been active in rescuing dogs from the meat trade in South Korea. She is here today to speak with us about her vegan life as a top performing athlete and to tell us about the dogs she has helped rescue from dog farms in South Korea. Hi, Megan, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today to tell us about your veganism and your animal advocacy. First of all, I understand you've been vegan since 2008 now. Can you tell us about what your life was like then as a figure skater and then how you came to find and transition to veganism?
Yeah, I kind of like stumbled upon veganism accidentally, I guess you could say. I saw this book that kind of seemed funny called Skinny Bitch. It was very small. I kind of read the cover and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And to be honest, I'd never even heard of vegan people before or a vegan diet. I kind of ate whatever was available to me without much knowledge. So I was like, oh, this might be an interesting project. And I'm always looking for new challenges and new projects. So that was really what led me to seeing if I could do this vegan thing. And, you know, against the research that I saw, I jumped into it cold turkey. I kind of went all out. I woke up the next morning. I cleaned out my fridge. I drank my coffee black because I didn't have any milk alternatives. And I went from there. And, you know, I didn't make this decision and think it was going to be a lifelong thing or become a passion of mine. But as time went along, I started to feel so much better with my health. And I noticed changes in my body. And that was kind of what kept me on the path was all the positive changes.
Cool. And Skinny Bitch has been known to change a lot of people's lives. So it doesn't only talk about health issues, but also animal issues as well. Can I ask if that, like, what was it that it convinced you about it to try to go vegan from the Skinny Bitch book?
It was mostly the nutritional aspect, actually. You know, I always loved animals, but I had never really thought about the food I was eating, how they were animals. You know, you kind of like don't bring that up. You push it to the back of your mind and you don't think about those things. Yeah. So it wasn't really an animal rights issue. It was mostly from a nutritional standpoint. And first of all, understanding how unnecessary dairy was for adults and for human beings. And that's kind of where it led from. And then, you know, as time went on, I found that I was becoming a much more compassionate animal lover. And so things kind of shifted towards that end as well over the years.
Well, after going vegan, you developed a deep interest in health and nutrition, and you even studied at the Canadian School of Natural Nutrition. You're a holistic nutritionist now. So you've been immersed in a world of competitive athletes for many years in your life now. What would you say are the biggest myths that are still circulating in the top performing athletic world with regards to performance and nutrition? There's still a lot of misinformation out there, and are athletes still being encouraged to consume meat and string cheese like you were? Or are times changing, do you think?
Sadly, I don't think times are changing. You know, I studied, I got my degree in holistic nutrition. I'm now doing some extra certifications with Alive Academy, and I'm studying sports and fitness nutrition and vegetarian nutrition with them. You know, I sometimes take a look at some of the other figure skaters' nutritional meal plans from their dietitians, and there's so much food. They're being, told to eat so much and to drink milk before they go to bed and to drink eat all this meat. The number one thing that we're being misinformed about is the amount of protein we actually need. I think the most important thing is the quality of the protein you're eating and when you're eating it as an athlete. You're eating it after training for your recovery. It's not necessary to have in heavy amounts, and there's actually better quality protein in plant-based foods that your body can digest and use. And then there's also the dairy aspect that, you know, a lot of dietitians are telling athletes and including in athletes' meals plans, so much dairy and yogurt and cheese. And when you can't digest that stuff, how do you expect your body to perform at a high level in your sport? I find it kind of intriguing.
Yeah, I find that so weird too, because most people are actually lactose intolerant, and then there's actually Olympic athletes out there who are doing pro-dairy ads because they're sponsored, right? Have you heard of Dotsie Bausch and her plant milk challenge?
I did, and I was so excited. I saw it, and I was like, oh, I want to be part of this. I messaged them on Twitter. You know, there is, like, I find more and more athletes that are either vegetarian or they've taken out dairy from their diets. When we, as an athlete, for our recovery, you need your body to recover so fast from any type of injuries or heavy training, or if you need to go back to a heavy training. So putting dairy into your body causes inflammation. So you're stopping your body from recovering. So it doesn't make sense for athletes to be consuming dairy at all. And I see these campaigns where athletes are promoting Milk Life and milk products. And I mean, they're being paid money. And I think that that's why a lot of them do it. But I wish that more athletes would consider promoting healthier options.
Well, I was reading over your vigorous training schedule, and I think it's pretty incredible. I was wondering if you could kind of give our listeners an idea of really how hard it is that your training schedule is, your workout regime, what you do every day. And then I want to know after that what you eat to fuel all that work that you do.
Like, my training is a full-time job. You know, I wake up in the morning, and I usually wake up extremely early, between 5 and 5:30. I always want to be up a couple of hours before having to push my body in a sporting environment or a training environment, because I need to be focused. I need my body to feel mobile and loose and active, and I need to have fueled my body properly. So I wake up a couple of hours before I have to go and train, and I'm usually at the rink around 9 o'clock, and I do a 1 hour off ice warm up. So that's anything from light stretching and foam rolling to specific exercises that my physiotherapist and my osteopath have given me for injury prevention, and then to balance exercises, stability, and just waking up my body and getting everything ready. And then I go on the ice for 3 hours. 2 hours of that is spent working, like, just on the pair skating with my partner, Eric. And then another hour is either spent with us doing choreography work or me doing an extra single session where I just practice my jumps. And after that, we have a short break to drive to the gym training. And twice a week, I do strength and conditioning training in the afternoon. On the other days, I do Pilates, I do deep stretch class, I do yoga, I run. Every day is a different workout in the afternoon, depending on which day of the week it is. And then late afternoon, early evening is treatments from my therapist, osteopath, chiropractor, massage, acupuncture, physio. I see somebody every day that's helping my body recover.
So you must be really hungry after a day like that. Can you give our listeners an insight as to what are the kinds of meals that you're eating to fuel all these workouts?
Well, in the morning, I feel like that's the most important meal of the day, which we've all been told since we were really young. And it's true, especially because I do a bulk of my training before noon. So I do a lot of my training in the morning, and I usually have overnight oats for breakfast in the morning. I make my overnight oats the night before with banana, almond milk, chia seeds, hemp seeds, cinnamon, oats, of course. Sometimes I add some cacao powder in there for some magnesium, potassium, and to give it a little bit of a chocolate kick. Sometimes I add peanut butter. Depends. But my morning breakfast is typically overnight oats. Sometimes I'll have a smoothie if I'm in the mood for that. And I might not make, like, the most tasting smoothies, but I make, like, meal-filled smoothies with greens, with seeds, with almond milk and some fruit. So I turn my smoothie into a meal. So that's generally my breakfast, and that'll fuel me for my first hour of training off the ice. And then I go on the ice, and in between my training sessions, I snack on different things, from apples and bananas to trail mixes to Lara bars, different type of, like, oat bars and stuff. You know, I generally snack all day because I'm driving from one place to the other. So I can't really eat, like, a full lunch driving in my car. So I make a lot of muffins or some little yogurt and granola, like cups, like parfaits with coconut yogurt. So I snack on all that stuff in between training sessions. And then in the evening, I'll have a big dinner. Some of my favorite things are chickpea casseroles. I make a really good chickpea casserole with broccoli and carrots and onions and breadcrumbs and diet cheese. That's one of my favorites. I make vegan lasagna with kamut pasta, which is really good. Nice. Different bowls, maybe quinoa or a brown rice base with vegetables and tofu and peanut sauce. you know, my dinners will be anything along those lines. And I do have a sweet tooth, so oftentimes at night I'll treat myself to a cookie or a little piece of cake or something.
Well, you definitely deserve it. I always say after a good workout, I can have this treat because I worked hard and I deserve it.
Yes.
Now, I understand that since educating yourself and going vegan, you've been called upon to give advice to your fellow athletes because people were noticing that you were getting better and that, wow, like Megan is doing something that is actually surpassing everyone else. What is she doing? So can you speak about the role that diet plays in athletic performance and how this may compare to a diet that contains meat and other animal products?
I think the number one thing was a lot of people were noticing a change in my body, but a change in my performance. I have a lot more energy now. I sleep better. So I wake up and I'm rested and I'm ready to attack the day. And the number one thing that's happened since I've become a vegan is my injuries have gone down and my rate of recovery has accelerated. I'm ready for a hard training session so much faster than any other figure skater that I know. And I truly believe it's from what I'm fueling my body with. I haven't had any serious injuries. And I feel like that's also coming from fueling my body properly and taking care of myself on every level. So, you know, a lot of people notice these things and ask me for advice or ask me, you know, some coaches to help some of their younger skaters and educate them a little bit. When I was younger, I visited the nutritionist for our national team. And, you know, they're counting the calories of how much protein and how much fat and how much calories to have. And their suggestion to me was included a diet that included cheese strings. And I left that session with the dietitian and I was like, cheese strings, there's no nutritional value in the process ingredients in cheese strings. So why would I be told to have this? What good is that going to do to fuel my body? And that's really what opened my eyes into learning more about nutrition was I was being told to eat things that really didn't even have proper food or there was no nutritional density in a cheese string. So why would a professional tell me, a professional athlete, to eat that? So that was really what opened my eyes to learning more about nutrition and hopefully educating athletes more in the future in regards to proper nutrition.
Yeah, I understand. Like, tell me if this is true or false. I understand that in the Olympic villages, there are McDonald's and that's where the athletes go to eat.
Yes, there is a 24-hour McDonald's provided to the athletes at the Olympics. Oh, I really wish one day the International Olympic Committee will hire me to create the meal plan for the cafeteria, because not only is there a McDonald's, like there's white bread, white pasta, white rice. You know, there was no whole grains. There's no kale. There's no spinach. There's no Swiss chard. There's no leafy greens.
I'm in the Canadian military, and it actually sounds like the same kind of food that we're fed as well. So isn't that interesting? Like, the most high-performing people in our country are fed these kinds of foods still, but I hope there will be a change. I mean, are you seeing a trend in more athletes in your competitive arena who want to go plant-based so they might be having these challenges as well, and they need to start demanding that proper food be served?
Yes, and also athletes that just want to eat well and feel good.
Yeah, they just don't want to eat junk.
Yeah, so supporting just really a whole foods diet. This is so important on the steps to becoming vegetarian and maybe to becoming a vegan. Just a proper whole foods diet for everybody. But when you're an athlete and you're pushing your body to the limit, every part of my training is just as important as what food I'm putting in my body. Because I need to be energized, I need to be healthy, I need to be rested, I need my body to be sharp. So it doesn't make sense sometimes the food that we're being offered at events, and you're at the biggest competition in the world at the Olympics. And, you know, a lot of athletes are bringing their own food. I would make my overnight oats and bring it to the cafeteria. And I notice athletes doing that. And then a lot of people asking me, oh, what's in your oats? And a lot of curiosity.
Because obviously people want to do as well as you're doing as well, right? So
I think so, yeah.
Now we're going to shift gears a little bit. I want to learn more about your experiences in the past year in South Korea. You have actually done a lot of traveling to Asia in your skating career in the past 15 years. So you've been exposed to the culture and information there about the animals that people eat in these countries. Can you tell us about how you became involved in dog rescue and tell us about Muay Thai?
You know, over the years, as I was traveling to Asia, I always heard rumors that, like, you could go to these markets and sometimes they had buckets of dog meat or stuff like that. And so I had heard rumors like this, but I had never gone to those markets. So I never really knew. And when I went to Korea last year and I was thinking, oh, like I should do something about this. I should try to find a way to give back and to help if any sort of rescue groups were working with dog meat, the dog meat industry. So I did some research on Google and I found a group called Free Korean Dogs. There's a lot of groups doing great work. So this was just the one that I contacted and they got back to me the fastest. At first I was like, oh, I just feel like I should donate something. I should help them in some way. And then I found out that you could be a flight volunteer and just bring dogs back to Canada. And then they find them homes. So I thought, oh, this is great. Maybe I'm going to do that. And then I started thinking, why would I hope the dog gets a home? Like, why wouldn't I just keep this dog? I can give him a nice loving home. So that was what led me to adopting my dog. I had always heard rumors about dog meat being sold, but I didn't really know much about it. And, you know, I became a little bit more educated about that part of Korean culture, which is also part of Chinese culture as well.
I understand that the Gangwon province, where the Olympic Games were held this year, has 196 registered dog farms. That alone just blows my mind. Now, I know that during the Olympics, the restaurants in Pyeongchang were offered government cash if they stopped selling dog dishes during the games, but some declined, fearing that they'd lose loyal customers. When you were there recently for the Olympics, was this even an issue that people, the Olympians, were speaking about? Was it on the radar, or was it just hush hush and no one really knew about it, even though the Olympic sites were around many of these dog farms?
You know, it's pretty hush hush, but it seems like so many people, they just don't know. And then people would see in the news maybe, or online, some things that I were doing, and a lot of athletes came to me very interested in helping and working with this, which of course is amazing. We want to help the dogs, but I also think it's equally as important to help all animals. You know, I mean, I'm not only advocating not to farm dogs and eat dogs. I don't want anybody to farm any animals and eat any animals. So there's so many people interested in helping the dog meat trade. I just wish that there was more interested in helping pigs and cows and chickens and all these other animals. The restaurants in Korea that serve dog meat, they need a special license, but it's legal in Korea. And that's why, like you said, 196 registered dog farms in the province where the Olympics were being held. Whereas in China or some other countries, they might still farm dogs, but it's illegal. The government has made it illegal. Or in Korea, the government supports this business.
Well, you've been working with the Humane Society International, who just brought in over 80 rescued dogs from South Korea last week from a dog farm that they shut down, and they've brought them to their emergency shelter in Montreal. Can you tell us about what your experience was like in meeting and seeing these dogs?
Yeah, it was really fun and interesting to be able to go and see all those dogs so soon after they came over. A lot of them were really scared. You'd walk by their cage and they would go to the back, hovering and shaking and crying. There was one dog named Sunny that was extremely friendly. And out of the 80, there was one dog that wasn't scared and didn't feel threatened, wanted to be around people. The rest of the 79 dogs were terrified of human interaction. You know, I think it's amazing the work that the Humane Society International is doing. I think any organization that is trying to help this dog meat trade come to an end. And the Humane Society did such a great job bringing these dogs to Montreal. They're getting all their medical care, getting all the help that they can so that they can go find loving homes. They also will go through a behavior therapy program so that they are well adjusted to behave in a home environment.
Right. They definitely have come from a really horrific place and they'll be needing some therapy and a lot of love from humans. So can you tell us about Mutai, the mini dachshund? And is there also a beagle named Theo? And how are they doing now?
Yeah, I have two rescue dogs. I also have a rescue cat. I'm going to need a big farm before I get any more animals. Mutai was the rare one that was extremely confident and strong and happy. Like I told you, there was the one out of those 80 in Montreal that appeared to be friendly and loving right away and not scared. And when I was in Korea, and the lady who runs Free Korean Dogs, she was bringing Mutai to me to visit me in Pyeongchang, where I was. And as she was driving across Korea, she called me and she said, you know, Mutai is very strong. He's not scared. He's eating his food. He seems very, like, confident. He's just watching out the window. And she had another dog with her. Sarah that I was bringing back to Canada with Mute. And Sarah was very scared. Sarah was very sick, very scared. She was having accidents everywhere in the car and in the hotel. So, you know, there it was very different between the two dogs. Maybe I got very lucky with Mute. And he came to Canada and immediately fell in love with my rescue beagle, Theo. You know, he follows everything Theo does. So Mute became trained quite easily. And I think it's because he followed Theo everywhere. But Mute's very scared of all dogs. Theo is the only dog he's friendly to at all.
Wow. I understand that Mute was originally rescued by a Buddhist monastery, and now he just loves to meditate with you.
Yes. You know, I was looking at the Free Korean Dogs website, and they listed all the dogs that they had available for adoption. And I saw this little dachshund mix with a blue blanket over his head. And it said that, you know, he's currently being held at a Buddhist monastery, and he follows the Buddhas to their meditation classes and just sits with them. And I thought, oh, maybe this is some special spiritual dog that I need to bring into my life. You know, that he's exactly like that. He sits on the yoga mat while I do yoga or I meditate, and he sits there and he watches me. And Mute is kind of interesting too, because it's hard to explain, but his front paws, his elbows are broken. So his paws are permanently, his arms are permanently turned out, and his elbows are pushed out to the side all the time. So when he sits, he makes like this funny shape, or when he's laying down or walking, which, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, a birth defect or abuse where he was bred, like, we're not sure.
Well, you say that embracing a vegan lifestyle has allowed you to naturally become a more compassionate person. We are talking about that, both towards animals and people. Can you tell us more about this and what you would like to say to your fans about how they may embrace a life of compassion and nonviolence?
Yeah, you know, that was a very interesting aspect for me since I became a vegan. I mean, I consider myself that I was a compassionate and empathetic person. I like to think that I always was this type of person, but I noticed, you know, maybe a year to two after eating a vegan diet, that a lot of like the tension and the aggression that I might have had in me and the anger subsided. Because I think when you eat food where these animals have been killed and they felt fear and they've been scared or they've been injected with antibiotics, and, you know, we're putting all of that into our body, and their emotion is how we are going to feel if we're eating that type of anger. I feel like that anger will come across on us. And it was really interesting to me, the patience that I found myself coming to life with, this patience and this compassion. And I think that's the surprising thing that happened to me since I became vegan. It's not something that I really thought about. And it trickles over to every aspect of your life, living a compassionate life, a positive life. And I feel like when you live a life, like a vegan lifestyle, you're naturally embracing a life that's filled with compassion and filled with love and filled with patience. And these are great, great things to bring to every aspect of your life.
And I think too, when you are embracing that lifestyle, it's not difficult to be vegan. It's just, as you said, it comes naturally.
Yeah, and it really just happened. Like, I slowly felt this change, and all of a sudden it grows, and it's become a passion of mine. So it's been able to evolve and to grow. But it did just, it kind of happened and caught me off guard a little bit when I noticed it. And I feel like I've allowed it to grow and grow, and try to educate more people about this type of lifestyle and this type of attitude and approach to life.
Well, you have a Stars on Ice tour coming up with a stop in Vancouver on May 13th. And I know you want to team up with vegan businesses while on tour. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I'd really like to, you know, I go on this tour across Canada every year. So I have my vegan hotspots around Canada and around each of the cities I go to. But I'd really like to team up with some of the businesses and maybe make appearances in the stores, do some work with them with future projects, maybe some contests where people can win some Stars and Ice tickets in those cities if they visit and support those local vegan or vegetarian restaurants. I'd really like to kind of work like that and work towards making a partnership with more of these businesses in the future.
Well, I know a lot of these businesses myself, so maybe we should talk and we can get you connected. That would be amazing to have you involved when you come in Vancouver. I'm sure people would love that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Megan, for coming on the show today to tell us what it's like to be a top world performing vegan athlete and your work in rescuing dogs from the South Korean dog meat trade. To find out more about Megan, you can visit her website at lutzofgreens.com. That's L-U-T-Z of greens.com. And you can find her on Twitter and Instagram. Go to our website, animalvoices.org, for these links. And once again, to support the efforts of this huge dog rescue at Humane Society International, go to donate.hsi.org. Thanks, Megan. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us on our next show next Friday, March the 30th, when we'll be talking a bit about Easter, and we'll also be acknowledging National Ferret Day, which we've never done before, so that's exciting. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end the show today, we're playing a song for the rescued dogs. It's called I've Got a Feeling, the Animal Rescue Song by Jane Olderman. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Just met you, but I can't forget you. I've got a feel about you, and it's different than expected, not like anything I've ever felt before. No, I'm sure this is our first. It's like heaven has not forgotten me. So overwhelming, the first time I held you, I started crying. A baby, I know it sounds crazy. What is this happening in my heart? And it's different than expected, not like anything I've ever felt before. Come home like a sweet song that I have heard for the first time. Yeah, I never bet all my dreams on that one in a million. Got a feeling about you.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Under the news radar, but in this show, the wild situation in a hot Arctic. The director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center, Mark Cerise, gives us the latest science. Climate information activist Jennifer Hines explains the Arctic methane monster. Scientist Paul Beckwith goes on megastorms. They are already here throwing 100-ton boulders up on the shore. Three guests, let's go. This is Radio EcoShock on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM. With a rising sense of panic about rapid warming in the Arctic, even during this past polar winter, it's time to check in with an expert in the field, Dr. Mark Cerise. He is the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center and professor of geography at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mark has a new book coming out in April about the development